it's all a show. Keep them laughing as you go. Just remember that the last laugh is on you. And
always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the right side of life.
Come on, Brian, cheer up.
Always look on the bright side of life.
If the government is going to release these documents to the public, the least they can do is give me my documents that they have about me.
Survivors of the Jeffrey Epstein sex trafficking network speak publicly for the first time at a rally on Capitol Hill.
It's Wednesday, September 3rd, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. The war in Ukraine has already changed that country beyond recognition.
You sit in a cafe in Kyiv and you meet one defense founder, and then 30 minutes later, another defense tech founder passes by.
But 3.5 years on, how long can Russia and Ukraine continue to wage war with such intensity?
Plus, the tiny filler word, gets a lot of hate.
We have established in corporate culture that to make a clear argument, you should sound as decisive as possible.
So, why do we all use it? First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. President Trump says New Orleans could be the next city to see National Guard deployment as part of a federal effort to fight crime. NPR's Franco Ordonez reports Trump says the governor of Louisiana welcomes the move.
President Trump says his administration is currently considering sending troops to Louisiana instead of Illinois, where state and local officials have vowed not to cooperate with the administration.
So we're making a determination now. Do we go to Chicago, or do we go to a place like New Orleans, where we have a great governor, Jeff Landry, who wants us to come in?
Trump says he wants to send the National Guard to Chicago, but that local officials should ask for federal assistance. He's also floated the idea of sending troops to New York and Baltimore. Franco Ordonez, NPR News, the White House.
A bipartisan group of lawmakers is pushing for legislation that would require the Justice Department to release files related to convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. House GOP leaders oppose it, but four Republicans, including Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, have signed a petition that would force the House to vote on the bill.
I ask my Republican colleagues not to choose just one path for justice and transparency and accountability, but I ask my Republican colleagues to choose every path for justice and accountability and transparency.
Outside the Capitol today, a group of Epstein survivors and family members of victims shared their stories, calling for the full public release of the files. Among them was Sky Roberts. His sister, Virginia Giuffre, died by suicide earlier this year.
She fought to expose a system that allowed the wealthy, the connected, and the powerful to exploit and abuse girls and young women without consequence. She fought for every survivor who was silenced, doubted, or discarded.
House Speaker Mike Johnson has expressed skepticism, citing concerns about victim privacy. A federal watchdog agency says about 10% of employees have left the Federal Emergency Management Agency this year. NPR's Rebecca Hersher reports the departures have left FEMA strained as peak hurricane season unfolds in the U.S.
Between January 1st and June 1st, about 1,400 workers left FEMA. That's according to a new report from the Government Accountability Office. They include workers who retired, who were laid off, and who voluntarily left the agency. The report warns that those departures could make it difficult for FEMA to respond to weather disasters, such as major hurricanes. Peak hurricane season in the Atlantic is underway now and runs into October. Rebecca Hersher, NPR News.
At the close on Wall Street, the Dow was down 24 points. This is NPR News in Washington. A federal judge heard arguments today about a deal between the Justice Department and Boeing over two fatal crashes of 737 MAX jets. NPR's Joel Rose reports the families of some crash victims object to the agreement.
Federal Judge Reed O'Connor in North Texas held a 3-hour hearing to consider objections to the deal that would allow Boeing to avoid criminal prosecution. He heard anguished testimony from relatives of some of those killed in the crashes of two 737 MAX jets in 2018 and 2019. The plane maker agreed last year to plead guilty to a single count of conspiracy to defraud regulators. But Judge O'Connor rejected that deal, in part over concerns about the selection of an independent monitor. This time, O'Connor questioned the Justice Department about the decision to drop the independent monitor entirely and hire a compliance consultant instead. The judge said he would issue a decision in due course. Joel Rose, NPR News.
Florida could become the first state to eliminate vaccine mandates, a longtime cornerstone of public health policy aimed at protecting school children and communities from infectious disease. The state surgeon general calls existing vaccine requirements an intrusion on personal rights, adding that parents should decide whether their kids are vaccinated. But physician groups say vaccines are safe and critical to preventing the spread of disease. Some Democratic lawmakers say the move is a public health disaster in the making. Stocks traded mixed on Wall Street today. The Dow was down 24 points at the close. The Nasdaq up 218. The S&P rose 32 points. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
It's 4:06. Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from Sanford Health, with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. Partly cloudy tonight, lows 34 to 38, northwest winds 5 to 10, patchy frost early tomorrow, showers are likely, mostly cloudy, highs near 55, winds from the northwest 5 to 10, gusting higher.
From NPR News, I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. We begin this hour here in Washington, where today more than a dozen survivors of convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein spoke out at a rally on Capitol Hill. For hours, survivors, including Marina Lacerda, identified in Epstein's 2019 indictment as Minor Victim 1, shared their stories.
They have documents with my name on them that were confiscated from Jeffrey Epstein's house and could help me put the pieces of my own life back together.
The rally was part of a bipartisan effort to go around House leaders to compel the government to release the records. NPR congressional correspondent Claudia Grisales is following this. Hey, Claudia.
Hey, Mary Louise.
So, just remarkable. This is the first time the public is hearing from some of these survivors. And as we noted, it went on for hours. Right. What stood out to you?
Right. It was, as you said, very remarkable and unprecedented. Hundreds gathered with signs to support survivors and pushing for transparency. And also, it was a reminder these survivors want to be humanized and they want closure after decades of suffering. I talked to the family of the late Virginia Roberts Giuffre, a high-profile survivor who died by suicide earlier this year. Here's her sister-in-law, Amanda Roberts.
She fought for this to the very last day she was here. And so we just feel this pull to pick up that torch, to pick up that mantle, to make sure that her voice stays alive.
So many of these survivors, they still need answers that are in these files, like Marina Lacerda, who we heard at the top, who spoke out publicly for the very first time. She says in order to heal, she needs to access her memories in these files. And the worst part is knowing the government has information that she does not.
Right. And part of the issue has been that her personal experience and some of these other women is at the center of a political brawl, and that all of the allegations that President Trump is trying to cover up the extent of his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein, and so is refusing to release the documents. How do these survivors respond to all that?
Well, they say Republicans hold the key to ensuring this never happens again by releasing the records. They argue many have yet to be held to account. But Trump told reporters at the White House today that this is just a political stunt.
It's really a Democrat hoax because they're trying to get people to talk about something that's totally irrelevant.
And this is also salt in the wound. Many survivors were visibly distraught today by Trump's repeated references to this as a Democratic hoax.
Well, to remind, this all became a hot political issue because Trump and Republicans promised to release the files on the campaign trail. Where do Republicans stand now on the release?
Well, Leaders are backing a House Oversight Committee probe into the case, but survivors and lawmakers that have signed on to this petition to force a release of these records say that falls short. So we're seeing this new splintering of the party as a small, albeit loud, group of Republicans are being led by Kentucky Congressman Thomas Massey to force a vote on this records release. For example, Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, Nancy Mace of North Carolina are also on board with Democrats, but they still need two more Republicans to sign on to what's known as a discharge petition to override leadership and get this bill to the House floor.
And just briefly, Claudia, what comes next in this whole controversy?
Well, survivors said today they are going to compile their own list of participants in this sex trafficking network if Congress and President Trump do not act. And the Oversight Committee will also continue their work. They've issued dozens of subpoenas, so more records are expected to be released, and they're seeking more interviews with witnesses.
NPR's Claudia Grisales, thank you.
Thank you.
The justices of the U.S. Supreme Court aren't scheduled to meet with each other face-to-face until the end of this month, but already there's a legal truckload of Trump administration appeals that the court will almost certainly have to decide this term, and each day seems to bring another blockbuster. NPR's legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg is here in the studio with more. Hi.
Hi there.
So, Nina, it's been 9 months of the Trump administration, and it's an administration that has seen a number of legal challenges. What might we expect from the court this term?
You know, whatever I tell you this evening will be superseded or added to tomorrow or the next day. And that's because the Supreme Court, after dancing around most of the challenges to Trump executive orders, will soon face a bunch of cases that can't be avoided. They can't be kicked down the road. Mm-hmm. I say dancing around because the court, for the most part, until now, has blocked lower court decisions against Trump on a raft of issues, but these blocks, or stays as they're called, are only temporary when the cases play out in the lower courts. But now, nearly a year into the second Trump administration, the lower courts, both district and appeals courts, have issued full-blown decisions in some of these cases, really big cases, and the court will have to deal with those lower court decisions on the merits, not on the question of a temporary stay.
Got it. So tell us, Nina, what is the biggest case facing the Supreme Court at the moment?
Well, it depends a little bit on what floats your boat.
Okay.
In terms of the structure of modern government and the economy, it's probably two issues: tariffs and the Federal Reserve Board. First, tariffs. This week, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit ruled by a 7-4 vote that the president exceeded his authority imposing tariffs worldwide with virtually no restraint. The circuit court stayed its ruling to allow Trump to appeal to the Supreme Court, and that means that we almost certainly will get a decision on Trump's tariff power this term.
Okay, so that was tariffs. What about the Federal Reserve Board?
Well, the court in recent months has all but formally overturned a nearly 100-year-old precedent that barred firing independent agency heads. But in one recent opinion, the court seemed to carve out an exception for the Federal Reserve Board members. Trump, who's made no secret of wanting to fire Jerome Powell, the head of the Fed, has now fired a different board member, Lisa Cook. She was appointed by President Biden, and her case is now kind of a test case. And that is making Trump allies in Congress and the business world very nervous, because the Fed, since its creation in 1913, has been viewed as an apolitical independent force for stability in the American economy. And all of this will undoubtedly come to a head in the coming months.
Last thing, Nina, I understand that President Trump's use of the Alien Enemies Act is another major case that is likely to make its way to the court. Tell us about that one, if you can.
Yes, that's the law enacted in 1798 that allows the deportation of immigrants in times of foreign invasion. It's a law that until now has been used only 3 times, always in wartime, declared war times, including to round up Japanese Americans and put them in camps during World War II, an action that both Congress and the Supreme Court have since repudiated. Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court earlier this year, rather than decide whether Trump's invocation of the Alien Enemies Act was legitimate, sent the case back to the very conservative Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals to answer specific questions. Among them, was Trump's action legal? And last night, a Fifth Circuit panel found that Trump's use of the Alien Enemies Act to deport undocumented individuals was illegal. Writing for the panel majority, Judge Leslie Southwick, a Republican appointee, found that even a mass illegal immigration is not an armed and organized invasion of the kind contemplated by the Alien Enemies Act.
Right.
There's also the deployment of the National Guard and Marines in California to handle protests against immigration enforcement activities. A federal judge ruled just a few days ago that the president didn't have the authority to do that, at least not without the consent of the state's governor, which he definitely didn't have.
All right. We have to leave it there. We are out of time. NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg, thank you.
Thank you.
We say and hear it all the time, and it's often frowned upon, but this two-letter filler word is a mighty building block of conversation. So for our latest word of the week, let's have a talk about NPR's Ayana Archie has more.
We use for good reason. It fills the space when we're trying to think of what to say next. It can soften our tone to make us sound more casual or polite. It also signals to people that we're not done talking, which is known as turn-holding.
That buys you time and helps prevent other people from talking over you.
That was Jessa Ferris, an etymologist and co-host of the Words Unraveled podcast. Delphine Dahan leads a psycholinguistics lab at the University of Pennsylvania.
The planning of this word doesn't take much effort, which means that's something that speakers can produce on the drop of a hat.
Because of this, filler words with similar sounds and uses show up across languages and cultures. In France, it's an ugh sound. Brits and Australians say Despite its dominance, gets a lot of hate.
We have established in corporate culture and in public speaking and rhetoric that to make a clear argument, you should sound as decisive as possible.
So, where did come from? The earliest record of the word is in plays written by John Marston. He was an English playwright who used as early as 1604, the Oxford English Dictionary says. People typically don't write down because we have time to pause and think about what's next. But younger people have started writing informally to express humor, confusion, irony, or signal a correction. TikTok captions say things like, is this normal? Mignon Fogarty has written several books on language under the moniker Grammar Girl. Here's what she had to say.
It does show up more in social media than in business emails or things like that. Situations where people are writing as though they were speaking.
Is still used mostly in face-to-face conversations. It tells the person you're still there and still thinking, so your commitment to the conversation isn't questioned.
If I'm the speaker, say you ask me a question and now I answer it, I have to give you an answer.
Isn't the bad guy. But if you want to use it less, it takes practice. You can start by speaking more slowly. Ayana Archie, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, our daily dose of phonology with John Latimer. Support comes from Bridget's Pub, located in downtown Bemidji, serving Irish and American food, offering Monday night trivia at 6:30 and open mic night on Thursday starting at 6:30. More on Facebook. The Metza Garden in Virginia has a fall plant sale and produce swap this Friday from 8 to 1. They are located on Bailey Lake on 3rd Street North.
On today's date, in 1992, it finds me and my family along the banks of the Cannon River in southeastern Minnesota. The tree that catches our eye is the walnut. The walnut in the fall is covered in lime-sized and lime-green fruit. These are certainly not limes on a walnut tree, but the walnut has this very swollen fruit with a heavy covering on it. My uncle used to harvest the walnut trees from his yard and scatter them on the driveway right in front of his garage. And then every day as he drove in and out, he would knock the husks off of the nuts. And it takes a bit of doing, and that was his solution for a problem. But here we are experiencing walnut trees, something not commonly found here in northern Minnesota, and looking at these giant swollen lime-like fruits and examining them and peeling them and looking at the nut underneath. Quite an exploration for some of us northerners.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from BritBox, committed to helping viewers to see it differently with British TV, with new original series like Code of Silence, about a deaf woman recruited as a lip reader in a high-stakes police investigation, streaming at BritBox.com. And from Your Part-Time Controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. YPTC.com/NPR. This is NPR.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Peace efforts in the Russia-Ukraine war appear to be going nowhere. Neither side appears ready for significant concessions. The fighting remains intense. So how long can each side wage war at this level? Well, we've called on NPR's Charles Maines in Moscow and NPR's Greg Myrie, who is just back in Washington after a month reporting in Ukraine. Welcome to both of you.
Hey, Mary Louise.
Hi there.
So, Greg, I'll let you kick us off. Ukraine is a big country, but it's a lot smaller than Russia. Where is it weakest as this war grinds on and on and on?
It's really troops. Ukraine has fewer troops than Russia, and this strain just grows as the war grinds on. Many of their frontline troops have been killed or injured, and they're having trouble replacing them with other well-trained recruits. Mm-hmm. Now, to compound the problem, Ukraine has really bad demographics. It has a shortage of young men, and it doesn't conscript them until they reach the age of 25. They can volunteer before then, but not that many do. When I was walking around the streets of Kyiv and other cities, it's striking how many young civilian men you see in these places. Now, Ukraine has launched a recruitment program this year for 18 to 24-year-olds. They can receive a sizable bonus if they sign up. We haven't been able to find any hard numbers, but so far the response appears pretty limited.
That's something, Charles, they've tried on the Russian side too, right? Big signing bonuses, like thousands and thousands of dollars. Is that the main way that they're raising troops on the for the Russian army?
It wasn't always. It's important to remember that Russia lost most of its elite troops early on in the war, really due to a huge miscalculation by Putin and his generals, who thought there would be minimal resistance with the invasion. So there have been really stages of Russia trying to reassemble its fighting force. Partial mobilization in the fall of 2022 dragged 300,000 civilians into the army, but it was very unpopular. I think you may remember those images of thousands of young Russian men fleeing the country. Yeah. They've also tried recruiting convicts, essentially giving them a chance to fight for their freedom, which was, of course, was controversial, but also limited in scope. And so you're right. You know, the solution has been money. There are huge payouts and signing bonuses for Russian contract soldiers, newfound privileges for military families. And this has all been effective in attracting people from Russia's poor regions in particular. These are small towns and cities in Russia's interior. So Russia seems to have enough soldiers to fight. The problem is these troops often aren't well trained. They're just not prepared for the battle.
Yeah, well, which leads to the next thing I want to ask you about, which is casualty figures. These have been hard to pin down on both sides. So I want you to catch us up on what we know. Greg, you first, then Charles.
Yeah, Mary Louise, we know the numbers are staggering, but it's just been impossible to get solid figures since neither side gives an overall number. Now, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky recently cited what he described as a fairly typical day. He said Russia had about 1,000 dead, wounded, or captured captured collectively. Ukraine had about 340 troops in those three categories.
And again, now, this is per day.
Per one day, yeah. One day. And he said this was a normal day, both in the numbers and the ratios. And it is pretty much in line with other estimates. So overall, since the full-scale war began, Ukraine has suffered perhaps somewhere around 400,000 military casualties. This could include up to 100,000 dead, 300,000 injured. This is an estimate by the Center for Strategic and International Studies
just
in Washington.
Just staggering. Charles, what about on the Russian side?
Yeah, you know, various monitoring groups and think tanks put the Russian casualty toll, that's dead and wounded combined, at around 1 million, with about a quarter of those fatalities. Russia's defense ministry now hasn't officially updated its figures since the early days of the war. President Vladimir Putin only talks in ratios. He claims, in fact, the opposite of what Greg describes, that for every Russian soldier lost, there are exponentially more lost on the Ukrainian side. What I can say is that if you visit a graveyard, a substantial amount of plots are devoted to war dead. And increasingly in the city, in cities like Moscow and St. Petersburg, for example, you see at train stations and airports, men missing limbs or otherwise disfigured, often dressed in fatigues.
So I want to put to you, Charles Mintz, the question that I kicked off with Greg Myrie. Where is Russia most vulnerable in a sustained war, which is clearly what we're heading toward?
Well, the most obvious concern here is running out of money to pay these soldiers. Russia's economy has surprised many with its resiliency, despite an onslaught of Western sanctions, but there are signs of trouble. The economy has increasingly shown weak growth. There are high interest rates that continue to squeeze borrowing and you know, skyrocket prices here. Signing bonuses for troops are actually going down now in some regions, meaning that at least some governors are looking at their budgets and realize they can't keep this up. Meanwhile, Russia's vulnerable in other ways. You know, Ukrainian attacks on oil refineries are causing problems, including outright gas shortages in some regions. And there's always the threat, again, on and off, of Trump, President Trump, issuing sanctions on Russian energy exports, which is what drives the Russian economy. Will Trump go that far? Well, he's repeatedly backed off previous threats, but I don't think anybody really knows, including Russia.
So we have talked through manpower or lack thereof. Let me turn you to hardware, to weapons. Greg, where is Ukraine going to get weapons now that President Trump effectively is halting U.S. military aid?
Ukraine is really ramping up their own production. They say they make about 40% of their own weapons now, and that's rising pretty rapidly. This is most evident with drones. Ukraine says it makes more than 90% of the drones it uses, and they keep getting better and hitting deeper and deeper inside Russia. Now, Ukraine also says they've developed a powerful missile that can travel 1,800 miles. It's called the Flamingo. Ukraine hopes to start full-scale production soon, so it's not yet proven, but a clear sign of what Ukraine is trying to do. I just attended a conference on Ukraine's rapidly growing defense industry. I met a guy named Yaroslav Ozhnuk, who runs two new companies making drones and drone parts.
Well, I lived in Silicon Valley for 6 years. I went through a very classic startup journey. Ukraine today is the defense valley of the world. You sit in a cafe in Kyiv and you meet one defense founder, and then 30 minutes later, another defense tech founder passes by. The energy here is just incredible.
So Ukraine still needs the West for larger, more powerful weapons. Europe is trying to step up under this plan where it can buy weapons from the U.S. and give them to Ukraine. We'll have to see how that works out.
And meanwhile, Russia is relying on foreign support from the likes of China, also Iran, North Korea. Charles, how's that support holding up?
Well, the scenes out of China this week, where Putin met with the leaders of China, North Korea, and Iran, suggest they're holding up quite well. You know, Iran was central to helping Russia develop its domestic drone industry. China remains the key lifeline to Russia's economy, both through its purchase of Russian energy, but also export of dual-use technologies back into Russia. So we're talking computer chips that find their way into some weapons. But North Korea has proven itself essential to Russia's actual military campaign. One estimate by the Open Source Center, this is a UK-based research group, found Pyongyang had provided some 40% of all shells fired by Russia since 2023, and that looks unlikely to change.
And NPR's Charles Mintz in Moscow, and NPR's Greg Myrie, who's just wrapped up a reporting month in Ukraine, now back here in Washington. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mary Louise.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
It is 4:29. You're listening to People Powered KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up in a moment, national Native news, and 1 hour from now, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. Support comes from ICTV. Stay tuned, stay connected with ICTV. Learn more at watchictv.org. We also thank Bemidji Brewing, announcing the release of the new Full Stinger Variety Pack featuring the Blood Orange IPA and Lemon Drop Blonde, available in liquor stores now. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. Partly cloudy tonight, lows 34 to 38, northwest winds 5 to 10, patchy frost early tomorrow, showers are likely, mostly cloudy, highs near 55, winds from the northwest 5 to 10, gusting higher. Lows tomorrow night near 40, and for Friday, mostly cloudy, highs in the mid to upper 50s.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The case had the potential to overturn decades of hard-fought legal battles to protect traditional fishing rights in rural Alaska. But in the end, the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals sided with the federal government in its lawsuit against the state to protect those rights. As KMBA's Rhonda McBride tells us, the win is a major victory for tribes.
This summer, for the first time in a long time, smokehouses along the Kuskokwim River were filled with bright red salmon.
We have no other choice but to prepare for hard winters, and it has been very difficult for us to meet our annual subsistence needs for the last 10 years.
Mike Williams serves on the Kuskokwim River Intertribal Fish Commission, which joined the federal lawsuit against the state.
As a fisherman in these hard times, I was very pleased on the Ninth Circuit decision.
The federal appeals court affirmed ANILCA, the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, a law Congress passed in 1980 that gives rural residents who are mostly Alaska Native top priority to harvest the salmon. The court says the state broke that law in 2021 when it ignored restrictions that federal managers imposed to save a struggling salmon run, as well as subsistence protections an Athabascan elder named Katie John had won in numerous court battles. The crux of the problem remains the state's constitution, which doesn't allow for a rural priority. Alaska's Attorney General Treg Taylor says he's disappointed in the decision, but not surprised. In a statement, he said the case would need to be decided at the highest level, yet stopped short of saying whether the state plans to appeal this case to the U.S. Supreme Court. And that has Joe Nelson, co-chair of the Alaska Federation of Natives, worried there could be more litigation ahead.
This is going to be just another chapter in the story that's going to continue.
Although this case involved one river, Nelson says there is so much at stake for all Alaska Natives. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
A youth curfew aimed at reducing violent crime in the Gila River Indian community in Arizona has been in place since late February. As KJZZ's Gabriel Piatrazio reports, the curfew will now be in effect through the end of the year.
It marks the fourth time the curfew has been extended. In this latest executive order, Governor Stephen Rowe Lewis wrote that the tribes south of Phoenix saw a decline in crime between June and August, but concerns over threats to public safety still remain, with Lewis adding that emergency action gives us stronger, more flexible tools to prevent violence and disorder before it starts. Leaders are even considering banishment as a solution. The tribe is surveying its membership about a draft ordinance to banish its own members who are convicted of committing violent crimes on the nearly 600-square-mile reservation. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Piatrazio.
The Spirit Lake Nation, the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa Indians, and Native voters are formally asking the U.S. Supreme Court to review their case involving Native voting rights in North Dakota in the court's upcoming term. They filed a petition Tuesday. According to attorneys, the plaintiffs have been fighting for fair representation for Native voters since 2022. Public statements and expert testimony in the Line 5 reroute begin Wednesday in Madison, Wisconsin, and Bridge Energy plans to build a new 41-mile segment of its pipeline. Tribal and environmental groups are among those in opposition raising environmental concerns, while supporters are pointing to jobs and an economic boost. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by the Colorado Plateau Foundation, supporting Native-led initiatives protecting plateau lands, waters, and cultures by building networks, community, and organizational capacity. Grant proposals accepted through September 5th at coloradoplateaufoundation.org.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Today, over 1,000 current and former federal health workers signed a letter urging Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to resign. The letter, which was addressed to the Health Secretary and to Congress, accuses Kennedy of endangering the nation's health. This comes days after the Food and Drug Administration imposed new restrictions on who's eligible for the updated COVID-19 vaccines, and after the Trump administration fired the newly confirmed director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Susan Menarez. One of the organizers and signatories of this letter is Dr. Elizabeth Soda. Until yesterday, she was a physician with the CDC's National Center for Emerging Zoonotic Infectious Diseases. She joins us now from Atlanta. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Soda, I know that you've been voicing your concerns about changes at the CDC for some time, for weeks now, but yesterday you finally took the step of resigning. Tell us what led you to make that choice.
You know, it wasn't an easy one, but I joined CDC to promote health, not only just for an individual, but for a large population. And now I feel like I have to leave CDC so that I can do the same and more freely advocate for these really important public health topics.
In the letter you and over 1,000 other federal health workers penned, you say, quote, "Our oath requires us to speak out when the Constitution is violated and the American people are put at risk," end quote. Dr. Soda, how, in your view, is Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the health secretary's leadership, putting Americans at risk? Give us an example.
Yeah, I strongly believe in the oath I took, and Secretary Kennedy is definitely putting us all at risk. I think his stance on vaccines is one very clear example of how he is politicizing the important public health action of vaccines, and it's going to have very serious consequences for all Americans at this point.
We reached out to HHS, and spokesperson Andrew Nixon told NPR in a statement that Secretary Kennedy has been clear about the CDC being, quote, "broken for a long time," and went on to say that restoring trust in it will take, quote, "sustained reform and more personnel changes." He also went on to say that the health secretary is committed to evidence-based science. What do you say to that?
I would argue the secretary is definitely not committed to evidence-based science, you know, based upon many of the actions he's already taken. Looking, for example, of what happened to ACIP and the people and appointees that he's putting at CDC who have clearly been not using evidence-based science to back many of their conclusions.
When you say ACIP, I assume you're referring there to the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices.
Correct. That is correct.
I wonder, do you worry at all that the series of recent departures from CDC are actually fulfilling the vision that the Trump administration and the health secretary have for the future of the agency?
You know, that is a really good question, and I think we definitely have to think about those things as we discuss these topics. But, you know, I will also say that CDC still clearly has a lot of really dedicated and wonderful public servants who are dedicated to continue its mission. And, you know, they want to be able to do their work and support the American public. So I do believe that because of these amazing individuals, CDC will continue to try to work and protect American lives as best they can.
I know that you've resigned, but I do have to ask you. We've seen a number of instances over the last few months of people who speak out against President Trump or his administration's policies facing a variety of negative consequences. Do you have any concerns about speaking out, going public yourself?
Yeah, of course. I think there's always risk. Not only from retaliation from the administration, but also how, you know, the general public is going to view us, and potentially the risk that comes with that. But, you know, I feel very strongly. I swore an oath, even if I have resigned, I'm going to hold by that oath for the rest of my life, and that is to speak out when I believe the Constitution and the American people are in jeopardy. And so the risk, I'm willing to take that risk in order to help promote the amazing work that we're trying to do to promote health among all Americans.
We've got about a minute left. States are beginning to take public health matters into their own hands. Florida just announced it intends to end vaccine mandates. Today, the states of California, Washington, and Oregon launched the West Coast Health Alliance to coordinate their own health guidance and vaccine recommendations rather than to rely on the CDC. In your view, should the country be making contingency plans to operate without the CDC, as we see these states doing?
I think, unfortunately, we're there, right? We're seeing states roll back these mandates. They're going to have consequences. Vax school mandates have helped. And I think that if CDC is not going to be able to provide that reliable voice, we are going to have to rely on our state and local health departments to step in and fill those gaps.
Last thing I'd like to ask, if Robert F. Kennedy Jr. does not resign as health secretary, as you and your colleagues, your former colleagues ask, what would you hope comes next for the CDC?
I do hope Congress takes action. You know, that's our big plea. Please, Congress, you know, take action and put someone in that role who is going to be able to follow evidence-based scientific data to make good decisions for the American public.
We'll have to leave it there. Dr. Elizabeth Soto was, until yesterday, a physician at the CDC, one of more than 1,000 federal health workers calling for Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy to resign. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Rainbow-painted crosswalks have disappeared in much of Florida. The State Department of Transportation has called them a safety issue. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has said the streets should not be used for political messages. In Tampa, the city government has decided to eliminate all its street art, including one that honors police. Megan Bowman with member station WUSF went to see it before the mural was erased.
Outside Tampa's downtown police station, a black, white, and blue street mural covers the asphalt for nearly a block. It says, "Back the Blue."
I came to take a picture of it before it's disappeared.
Rebecca Hessinger is a community planner for Hillsborough County. The mural is slated to be gone within the next 2 weeks.
It's just as stupid. Why would you do that? It doesn't harm the traffic. The traffic can figure this out.
A 2022 study found a 50% drop in crashes involving pedestrians or cyclists when asphalt art is present. But the Florida Department of Transportation says they're a safety hazard. Empowered by a new state law, it sent a letter to cities in July telling them to get rid of any permanent street art with political, social, or ideological messaging or risk losing government funding. Tampa resident J.J. Irish walks by the Back the Blue mural nearly every day on his lunch break. He likes it and thinks it brings people together. He doesn't buy the reason for the removal.
I think it's more than just the colors and the DOT safety. It means more to the community. So in my opinion, it's kind of BS.
In Orlando in August, under the cover of darkness, transportation officials removed a rainbow crosswalk honoring 49 victims of the 2016 mass shooting at the Pulse nightclub. The next day, people recolored the asphalt with chalk. Rain washed it away, but they colored it again. Governor Ron DeSantis says the streets had been commandeered by political messaging.
We're not going to use the roads for that purpose. The roads are there for either pedestrians to cross or cars to go, and that's what it's going to be.
Another victim of the street art sweep in Tampa are murals and crosswalks around schools. Some of them won awards from the state 4 years ago for innovation in traffic calming and improved safety. For NPR News, I'm Megan Bowman in Tampa.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's 4:44. You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, North Star Stories, produced by Ampers, news stories from communities throughout Minnesota. Support comes from the Bonner Eye Clinic, with locations in Grand Rapids and Hibbing, offering cataract surgery, LASIK, and general eye exams. BonnerEyeClinic.com. Let us help you see clearly. And support comes from the Pines Restaurant in downtown Grand Rapids, hosting a late-night patio party until 1 a.m. immediately following Riverfest, featuring Asian street food, handcrafted cocktails, and more. Restaurant info available at thepinesmn.com. The Virginia Area Historical Society's annual Fall Fest is this Saturday in the Lions Club building at Alcott Park, starting at 4 o'clock with grilled burgers and brats. The featured speaker is Mark Sage, who will talk about Frank Higgins, one of many sky pilots during the logging era. Thanks for listening to KAXE.
You are listening to North Star Stories, voices from where we live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
In today's stories, why Minnesota is suing TikTok. Then, as we approach the beginning of the school year, we take a look at the controversy and confusion around charter schools. And a Fond du Lac member is recognized for Native language revitalization. I'm Gracie J. Minnesota's Attorney General is suing TikTok, alleging that the company prioritizes profit over the well-being of young adults. The lawsuit accuses the company of violating the state's consumer protection laws. The complaint, filed in Hennepin County District Court, says TikTok entangles young users in cycles of excessive use by preying on their underdeveloped brains. It also alleges the company is using unlicensed virtual currency that is sexually and financially exploiting young TikTok users. Next, charter schools have been a part of Minnesota's education for decades, but many people still don't know what exactly a charter school is and how they compare to public and private schools. Faya Adam helps us to sort it out.
Minnesota is the birthplace of charter schools. The first charter school in the nation opened here in 1992. Today, more than 170 charter schools operate across the state, serving tens of thousands of students. But for many, the definition of charter schools is still unclear.
I think parents and families are, and this extends back through the history of like public education in the United States, are always vying for opportunities, the best opportunities for their children, regardless of what structures those opportunities take.
Professor Brian Lazensky is an associate professor and chair of the Educational Studies Department at McAllister College.
Whether you're looking at traditional public schools, private schools, charter schools, they're all very different from each other. They all serve very different populations of students. They all have very different kind of like missions and purposes.
Unlike private schools, charter schools are public. They can't charge tuition, and they must admit students through a lottery when demand is higher than available seats. But unlike traditional districts, they're run independently.
Charter schools are not subject to a particular school board. So there's not a, like what people say is a democratic process to elect the people who would be managing those schools. They're managed by authorizers, and then they're managed by directors of the school.
Charter schools may offer unique curriculum or specialized programs that traditional districts may not provide.
Each charter school is very different in what they do. The charter school that I work at, we focus on an accelerated and inclusive curriculum for all students. So all of our students upon graduation have completed either calculus or a college level math course.
Dr. Kate Hinton, a doctor of education, is the executive director at Math and Science Academy in Woodbury in the Eastern Metro area.
Other charter schools focus on, you know, some will work with students who have struggled in every school, and so they're trying to find a different way to connect with those students. So charter schools just give another option to families.
Dr. Hinton says charter schools have little differences at the core compared to public school districts. For example, While Math and Science Academy is a charter school offering an accelerated curriculum, it doesn't restrict admission based on a student's performance.
We're still a public school. We still work, you know, we serve special education students. We don't get to do any admissions testing. Not that we would want to, but we don't do that. So admissions to math and science, we have long wait lists, so it's always a lottery.
More than 30 years after the first one opened, charter schools have become a permanent part of the state's educational landscape. This is Faya Adam for North Star Stories.
You are listening to North Star Stories. A Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa staff member is being honored for her leadership in Ojibwe language revitalization. The Midwest Indigenous Immersion Network has named Eliza Savage as one of three fellows for 2025-2026. The fellowship recognizes emerging leaders who use Ojibwe Mo'in in daily life. Each fellow receives a $10,000 award to support their work. Fond du Lac leaders say Savage is a shining example of the community's efforts to preserve and strengthen the Ojibwe language and culture.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. When Sesame Street was created in 1969, it was a test. Could television teach children? The program was developed with lower-income families in mind, and the set was meant to represent a block in Harlem in New York. Here's more on how Sesame Street got its start from Rund Abdel-Fattah and Ramtin Arablouei, the co-hosts of NPR's history show Throughline.
The first episode of Sesame Street aired on November 10, 1969. Millions of dollars had been invested. Yet no one knew for sure if the show would work. Nothing like it had ever existed before. That first episode opens with weird animated creatures. One looks kind of like a cross between a unicorn and an alligator. The other, an armless, grinning blue guy wearing a bowler hat. It has a very 60s vibe.
Hello, Big Bird.
Big Bird is this big, dopey, disheveled-looking creature with sort of creepy eyes, a rough sketch of what we see today.
You're letting all the fresh air and sunlight in. Boy, I hate that.
Oscar the Grouch is orange.
Go away. Close my can lid, dear.
In the first scene of the very first episode, you meet the store clerk, Mr. Hooper, Bob the music teacher, and in the background, two kids, black and white, play with a ball. And then Gordon, the guy who owns the Sesame Street brownstone, calls into the window of his house.
Susan?
Yeah?
Susan's my wife. You love her. Susan, come here.
Hi,
why don't you say hello to Sally?
Susan is not a name that you name black children, okay? I inherited Susan. However, Susan was from the Midwest. She grew up on a farm. She had a father and a mother and a brother, and I use my own story.
Susan is you.
Yeah. It's me.
This is Dr. Loretta Long, who played Susan starting from that very first episode in 1969. She really did embody what Sesame Street has been doing since the very beginning, mixing education and entertainment.
One of these things is not like the others. One of these things doesn't belong.
In fact, during the first few years the show ran, Dr. Long was earning her PhD in urban education from the University of Massachusetts Amherst.
I have a riddle for you. What's closer to you than the air? And what stretches like a rubber band and comes in a lot of pretty colors like white, all shades of brown?
The fact black, that we could put yellow, entertainment and educational concepts together and make it more palatable for children, it fit me like a glove.
Well, did you guess? It was skin.
Sesame Street was always fun, but behind the scenes, it was also grounded in research about how best to educate kids. The show had support from President Lyndon Johnson, whose administration was laser-focused on eliminating poverty and reducing inequality.
Sesame Street was born at a time when the government was taking a bigger role in people's lives. Medicaid and Medicare had been created, the Civil Rights Act was passed, and the government was getting involved with what was on TV. Sesame Street first aired on the National Educational Television Network, which would become the public broadcasting system, PBS, the next year. Which is why even today, Sesame Street can feel so synonymous with PBS.
I was there, man. In 1969, nobody knew what the hell PBS was. Believe me.
Michael Davis is the author of Street Gang, The Complete History of Sesame Street.
In a lot of markets, you couldn't even find it. It was on a UHF station, and you're lucky if you could get rid of the fuzz and get a decent picture.
But the picture was pretty clear. In its second week, Sesame Street was reaching almost 2 million homes, and the reviewers loved the show.
I think the majority of people hailed it and loved it, and, you know, it was an immediate success. It was a blockbuster success. It was everywhere. But there were opponents from the very start. Notably, Mississippi Public Television refused to air the show. Why? Because black and white children were portrayed as being friends on the show and, you know, did things together, and it was as normal as normal could be. That was not going to fly in Mississippi until, the parents said, wait a minute, we want this show. We think our children should be able to see this show. And they resolved that conflict in the best of all ways. The people spoke.
The ban lasted less than a month, but the Mississippi government wasn't the show's only critic. Some educators themselves were questioning whether a TV show could really do a good job teaching kids.
They thought that the pace was too frenetic. They thought it was going to create a generation of kids with attention deficit disorder. And there were people who were really angry with it, suspicious of it, didn't like it one little bit.
I had a guy say, well, am I supposed to be entertaining my kids in the class? And I said, why not?
But Sesame Street was changing the game.
Kindergarten teachers had to rip up their curriculum. They had to start over because no longer were kids showing up not understanding the basics. They showed up ready to learn and to learn more.
A whole generation of kids in the 70s were coming to school more prepared. By 1979, around 9 million kids under the age of 6 were watching Sesame Street every day. And it wasn't just reaching, quote-unquote, disadvantaged children.
Within weeks of its premiere, it was clear that all boats were going to rise as a result of this show. A lot of people questioned the idea of the government getting involved in television, and the whole idea of a public television network seemed to them to be like just more liberal brainwashing. But once they started watching this show, immediately defended it, immediately took to it, immediately saw that it was like nothing else on television. And, you know, within a year, Big Bird was on the cover of Time magazine.
That was author Michael Davis and original Sesame Street cast member Loretta Long speaking with Throughline hosts Ramtin Arablouei and Rund Abdelfatah. You can hear the entire story on the Throughline podcast.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance, working to help protect small businesses and the owners who run them.
offering customizable coverages to salons, accounting firms, tradespeople, and more. Learn more at progressivecommercial.com. From Visit St. Pete, Clearwater, Florida, where white sand beaches meet the arts, from the Dalí Museum to more than 500 public murals. More at visitspc.com. From Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It is just before 5 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Stay tuned for another hour of All Things Considered, including the Up North Report, local news from our region at 5:30. Support comes from The Sewing Room, hosting the Cultivating Community.